When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth, not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
I'm going to read for you right here on this show a whole hour of the audiobook version of my new book, Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian. Like a whole hour of the book. And I have partially selfish reasons. It's not just that I'm excited about the work, and you've heard me reference it for months, but I really want you to be excited about it. I want you to like what you hear, and I'm hoping that you will be excited enough to support the full project. You can get the book in print form. You can get the Kindle. You can get the audio version. You can even get a signed copy if you want. I'm still doing that. Links to everything, SethAndrews.com. Okay? So I'm going to start with the introduction to the book, just a setup. It runs about 13 and a half minutes. And then we'll take a short break and I'll come back with all of chapter 2, which deals specifically with the phenomenon of right-wing radio in the United States. So now, without any further delay, let me play you the introduction to my new book, Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian. What's this country coming to? This lament is often heard in Oklahoma, the white bread, corn-fed, hand-over-heartland red state from which I hail. The question often accompanies misty-eyed nostalgia about what was, what is, and what might have been. It's a frowning rebuke of those godless, treasonous, America-hating so-called progressives, who somehow, despite their giddy obsession with abortion and condoms, have procreated themselves into a real threat to God and country conservatism. Liberals are the pockmarks on Lady Liberty's once pristine countenance. They must be stopped. Only a few years ago, I thought like that, I spoke like that, I lived like that. Had a neurosurgeon dessected my anterior cingulate cortex, he likely would have found a gooey red, white, and blue tumor created by AM radio frequencies blasting the rants of people like Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and Glenn Beck. Every broadcast provided a fresh opportunity for outrage. Most of those suspiciously white and wealthy hosts shrieking indignation for 3 hours every weekday as their suspiciously white and middle-class listeners angrily clawed the steering wheels of their suspiciously foreign cars. America was under attack, damn it. and it was the sworn duty of every God-fearing, flag-waving, true-blue patriot to rise up and defend her honor. Yet outside of some water-cooler blather between my Republican buddies and me, the only thing rising was my blood pressure. I voted only in the presidential election and only along straight party lines. I participated in just one conservative political rally, and by participated, I mean I stood in a parking lot with a homemade sign and occasionally yelled, "Yeah," at conservative politicians. I knew little about my local government, my state government, or my federal government, and what I did know about the two major political parties was spoon-fed to me by the frothing daytime talkers and a single television network, Fox News. Fox News spoke to me. Its flash and patriotic set designs, its smooth and sexy hosts. Well, many of them were sexy. Its rapid-fire delivery of affirming, heartland-friendly stories that passionately stroked my Republican skin like it was William F. Buckley's cat. I was a primetime Fox News addict, daily fueling my righteous discontent about the liberal assaults on this great nation, convinced that CNN and the big three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, were all in league with each other and with the devil himself, to replace this country with some kind of liberal New World Order. With Fox News, there was finally a network for the rugged individualist, the staunch capitalist, the Second Amendment warrior, the God defender, the common man. Founded in 1996 by Australian billionaire Rupert Murdoch and run for 20 years by former Republican media consultant and television exec Roger Ailes, Fox News has blossomed into a ratings behemoth, the fifth most watched network in prime time in all of television, and constantly ranking number one among cable news outlets. It's also a major moneymaker. Fox Corp earnings topped $2.5 billion in 2019. Fox News is a media bullet train. Its popularity and ratings dominance used as a shield against its critics. Hey, they're kicking ass out there, so they're obviously doing something right. Criticisms yet remain, the network long prompting disdain among many progressives, who protest that the whole damn channel constantly explodes in your face like a Republican Party convention balloon. As such, liberals sometimes snicker about fake noise and fuck news. But back in the day, I was hooked. Straight out of the gate, Fox News versus CNN felt like a holy war. And as I was the product of a hugely conservative, fundamentalist Christian, rah-rah Ronald Reagan culture, I often parroted notions of the mainstream media, blissfully unaware of the irony that Fox News's ratings dominance and crazy cash flow made it more mainstream than many of its competitors combined. Somehow, even from its glitzy mansion on Murdoch Mountain, Fox News was considered the rogue, the rebel, the Robin Hood, the David to CNN's Goliath. Other networks were off-kilter. Fox News proudly pronounced itself with the trademark slogan, "Fair and Balanced," a not-so-subtle indictment of American television journalism. Fox News's blue-chip players have become brands of their own, and with a few suspiciously, dare I say it, fair exceptions, like the recently departed Shepard Smith, Chris Wallace, and a few others, Fox News has remained doggedly right. So much so that New York Mayor Bill de Blasio blamed Fox News for the stunning 2016 presidential victory of Donald Trump. The implication is staggering. A single network pushed its weight, and its legions of viewers tipped the scale. Years ago, I might have proudly tipped right along with them. I'm fascinated by the younger portrait of myself, the conservative couch Christian who baptized himself in a sea of outrage, lamenting the decline of Western civilization at the hands of the liberal, the progressive, the permissive, the secular, and the godless. I couldn't yet know that I would one day come to reject the religious teachings of my youth, to stand among the heathens. The fear of godlessness is deeply embedded in American culture. Even a quick dictionary.com search for the definition of godless reveals the description of a person having or acknowledging no god or deity, atheistic, wicked, evil, sinful. That's in the definition. So, how can one be a good American if he or she is wicked, evil, and sinful? A January 2017 Pew Research survey revealed that 32% of Americans believed a true American must first be Christian. Among white evangelical Protestants, that number almost doubles to 57%. As Yahweh, the biblical God, the Christian God, owns the earth, the land, the gold and the silver, and all of humanity, and as Bible law trumps any of that pesky state church language in the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, the faithful gladly proclaim God's dominion over America with absolutely no sense of irony about religious privilege in a representative republic. Of course, this makes sense. They're the privileged. Why would they consider it a problem? This majority rule attitude feeds on itself. With most American citizens identifying with some flavor of Christianity, mob rule quickly takes over. A nation with Christians becomes a Christian nation, and the secular framework of the United States almost collapses beneath the weight of the steeples and crosses, the soapboxes of preacher politicians, and the avalanche of ratings porn outrage that splashes down every day from Fox News headquarters. How had I bought into this notion of a star-spangled theocracy? How had I once been a Fox News Christian? Well, the answer is simple. From my earliest memories, Christian conservatism was my second language, taught and reinforced by my parents, siblings, friends, teachers, guardians, books, toys, music, shows, films, and Sunday sermons. My mother and father were fundamentalists. They were Bible scholars, theologians. They met at Oral Roberts University. My mother wrote a Greek New Testament study guide, and she teaches New Testament Greek even today. My childhood stories were Bible stories. My Sunday activities were church activities. My school lessons were religious lessons. My parents were hardcore religious right conservatives, and they did everything in their power to ensure that their offspring would one day wave the family standard. Republicans for God and country. I spent the fourth grade in an ultra-conservative isolation chamber called Temple Christian, a tiny, church-owned private school in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I wrote about TCS in my 2012 autobiography, Deconverted, but it warrants mention again here. Temple Christian didn't just teach a Christian nation narrative. It dressed every student in school uniforms that were literally America's colors, red, white, and blue. Instead of raising our hands with a question for the teacher, we placed tiny American flags into slots between the desks. Our salutes to the American flag were always followed by pledges of allegiance to the Christian flag and the Bible. Overtly and subliminally, throughout my education and across the narrow spectrum of my young life, the linking of the United States and the Christian God was constant. I was part of a culture groomed to propagandize, the American flag in one hand and a Bible in the other. Interestingly, I never did hurl myself into the mission field. I never even left town. Rather, I found opportunities for religious and political reinforcement in Christian echo chambers close to home. And with few exceptions, I surrounded myself with affirmation. I associated with no known atheists, and the few Democrats I brushed up against seemed like foreigners who had stumbled into the United States by accident. The Oklahoma liberal is an anomaly rarely encountered in the wild, possibly because it's so often spooked by the sounds of native Republicans molesting their rifle triggers and beer cans. In my narrow perceptions, liberals were them, the opposition, the other. Conservatives went to Sunday church. Liberals selfishly slept until noon. Conservatives promoted traditional family values. Liberals co-mingled in an orgy of sin, passing their partners around like a bong. Conservatives respected America. Liberals dismissed borders and happily gifted precious American jobs to illegals. In all seriousness, this insipid caricature was how I once perceived the non-conservative and non-Christian. And galvanizing my worldview day and night was that hub of righteousness and truth-finding, Fox News. Fox was a mentor, a friend, a conduit and outlet. It simultaneously fed my perceptions and amplified them. And it constantly reminded me that I was both empowered and a victim. Here, on the wider side of the looking glass, I'm fascinated by Fox News and the culture that feeds on it. This book is an attempt to understand and expose the foe within the Fox. It's also a retrospective, a reverse engineering of my former beliefs about the United States, its founding fathers, patriotism, political parties, religions, foreigners, war, protest, gays, guns, and God. You're invited to join the older, wiser Seth Andrews as he investigates his former self and asks the question, what were you thinking? This is my diary. This is my penance. These are the confessions of a former Fox News Christian. So that's the setup for the book. Then chapter one gets into the origins of Fox News, the power players behind the network, why it is what it is. And then the second chapter is the one I'm going to play after the break. It's called The Rush to Anger, Right-Wing Radio and the Angry White Male. I'll play the whole thing for you right after this. Hang on. Of course, this whole broadcast is about an audiobook, but if you want to add to that library and you want to listen to or read nonfiction books that are kind of boiled down to their essence, so you can read more of them in a shorter amount of time, here's a great resource, Blinkist. Blinkist works on your browser, your phone, your tablet. It boils the best key takeaways and need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction bestsellers into about 15-minute blinks that you can read or listen to. 27 different categories to choose from. You can digest a whole book in one single sit on the couch or a quick drive or a walk or a workout. Also, Blinkist has original podcasts from top authors and even full-length audiobooks if you want to take the deeper dives. Great for entertainment, personal growth, increasing your knowledge base. Hugely relevant book on Blinkist right now is the autobiography of Martin Luther King Jr. It's distilled to about 18 minutes, a great primer on the history of the man. Also, check out Jamie Metzl's book called Hacking Darwin. It gets into the future of genetic engineering, the technical possibilities, and of course, the moral implications. I read the whole book. Actually, I listened to it while I was straightening up the office, right? I was listening while I worked. It was fantastic. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Seth to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership and up to 65% off audiobooks, which are yours to keep forever. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/Seth to get 25% off a premium membership and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Seth.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
All right, here we go. A whole chapter from my new book. This particular chapter really doesn't deal very much with Fox News itself, but I'm interested in the culture. And again, this is my past. You know, this is what I came out of. But Fox News and right-wing conservative radio are kind of a 1-2 punch. They really do play off each other. And I'll bet if you go and you ask a Fox Newser, hey, do you listen to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Laura Ingraham, Michael Savage, etc.? There's a pretty good chance that they will say yes. And these two correlate. Their messages are very similar. The culture is very similar. And I felt like it warranted a whole chapter. If you want to get into the origins of Fox News, where the network and its power players came from, how it brands itself, its messaging, its influence on the culture, all that's elsewhere in the book. But this specific chapter is called The Rush to Anger, Conservative Talk Radio and the Angry White Male. Thanks for listening, my friends. I hope you enjoy the chapter. In the early weeks of the NFL pro football season, it was the Philadelphia Eagles versus the Buffalo Bills. It was September 28, 2003. The ESPN Sports Network had been in hot water for its recent hiring of controversial conservative talk radio giant Rush Limbaugh as a pundit. And as the TV cameras rolled on ESPN's Sunday NFL countdown, the water boiled over. The panel, also consisting of Steve Young, Michael Irvin, Tom Jackson, and Chris Berman, wondered if McNabb's performance as an athlete had been regressing. Sure, his team had won the game, but had Donovan McNabb been the cornerstone for the win? Did the quarterback genuinely deserve so much credit? Rush Limbaugh, unfortunately, offered his opinion. He made the discussion about race. Quote, "I'm sorry to say this, I don't think he's been that good from the get-go. What we have here is a little social concern in the NFL. The media has been very desirous that a black quarterback can do well, black coaches and black quarterbacks doing well. There is little hope invested in McNabb, and he got a lot of credit for the performance of this team that he didn't deserve. The defense carried this team." Rush's co-host deftly skirted the racial portion of his claim and returned the conversation to athleticism and playmaking. But the damage had been done. Limbaugh was asserting that Donovan McNabb was an overrated player protected by the NFL establishment because he was black. And the NFL was merely trying to sell a public image of diversity at the QB position. In fact, 2003 saw black quarterbacks starting at least one game in 10 of its 32 teams. Rush's little editorial cost him the job. After political pressure from a few dozen U.S. House politicians and an avalanche of public outrage, ESPN accepted Limbaugh's resignation. The remaining Sunday NFL countdown hosts faced public criticism for letting Rush's rant go unchallenged. And on the following broadcast, Tom Jackson admitted as much. Quote, "Rush Limbaugh is known for the divisive nature of his rhetoric. He creates controversy, and what he said Sunday is the same type of thing that he said on radio for years. A player in this league who has a young son called me this week, and his son now wants to know if it's all right for blacks to play quarterback. Rush Limbaugh's comments could not have been more hurtful. He was brought in to talk football, and he broke that trust." Interestingly, the New York Times reported that Limbaugh's final Sunday NFL countdown was the highest-rated episode in 7 years. So what happened that day? Did Rush simply, accidentally misspeak? Of course not. Limbaugh told millions exactly what he was thinking. Earlier that same year, hardcore conservative Michael Savage paid a similar price. Savage had built his significant Savage Nation radio audience under the original slogan, "To the right of Rush and to the left of God." And he frequently gave his Bronx cheer to undocumented immigrants, calling them brown supremacists, gays, the homosexual mafia, and the left, socialists. Savage ranted about turd world nations, and he warned that the United States was being taken over by, quote, the freaks, the cripples, the perverts, and the mental defectives. Note the title of his 2005 book, Liberalism is a Mental Disorder. And notice the publisher, Thomas Nelson, the leading world provider of Bibles and Christian books. Over the objections of employees, MSNBC president Eric Sorensen hired Michael Savage for a one-hour television talk show. Sorensen thought Savage's style would translate well to television, and he likely felt the pot-stirring firebrand would bring a ratings punch to his meandering news network. He was immediately warned of calamity by organizations such as the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, which had already led an advertiser boycott of Savage's radio talk show. The concerns were warranted. It took Michael Savage only 4 months to torpedo his MSNBC gig. On the July 7, 2003 broadcast, a prank caller insulted Savage's teeth. Bristling from behind his sunglasses, the host responded, quote, "Oh, so you're one of those sodomites. You should only get AIDS and die, you pig. How's that? Why don't you see if you can sue me, you pig? You got nothing better to do than to put me down, you piece of garbage? You got nothing to do today? Go eat a sausage and choke on it. Get trichinosis. Now, do we have another nice caller here who's busy because he didn't have a nice night in the bathhouse who's angry at me today? Put another sodomite on. No more calls? I don't care about these bums. They mean nothing to me. They're all sausages." Watch the YouTube video clip of the exchange, and you can taste the bile. MSNBC quickly pulled the plug, and Michael Savage groped for an excuse. Apologizing the next day on his radio show, he argued that he thought MSNBC had gone too commercial. I'm not sure how this excuses the behavior. Savage also explained, "I meant to insult him, the caller, personally, not all people with AIDS." What's surprising is that anyone found this outburst surprising. Michael Savage had built his empire on Mount Antipathy, and even his termination from MSNBC didn't slow his goose step. In his 2004 book, The Savage Nation, Savage called MSNBC reporter Ashley Banfield a mind slut with a big pair of glasses. He lamented that Latinos breed like rabbits and called Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg a radical left-wing buck-toothed hag. The cases of Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage reveal an interesting phenomenon. These radio powerhouses enjoy monumental, even historic, success within the relatively closed systems of conservative talk radio stations. Yet when they attempt to play beyond their primary sandboxes, they almost immediately self-destruct or find themselves scrambling against public contempt. Fortunately for them, talk radio is a relatively confined hub for conservative male discontent. Where liberal talk experiments have crashed and burned, Ed Schultz, Randy Rhodes, Alan Combs, etc., conservative talk shows constitute a huge piece of the radio pie. Talkers Magazine published its 2019 Heavy 100 list, ranking the most powerful and influential hosts in the United States. The top five are as follows. Number one, Sean Hannity, Christian conservative. Number two was Rush Limbaugh, also a Christian conservative. Dave Ramsey at number three, Christian conservative. Mark Levin at number four, he is a Christian conservative. And number five, Howard Stern. Finally, a liberal. In the talkers listing, Fox News' Brian Kilmeade ranked at number 7. Glenn Beck rounded out the top 10. Former National Rifle Association spokesperson Dana Lash ranked number 17. Michael Savage was number 20. In terms of specific listener numbers, the rankings play out like a greatest hits of white conservative males. Rush Limbaugh, 15 million. Sean Hannity, 15 million. Dave Ramsey, 13 million. Michael Savage, 11 million. Glenn Beck, 10.5 million. Mark Levin, 10 million. Forbes magazine published a 2015 op-ed pondering why all the talk radio stars are conservative. The article explored the liberal trends toward media outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NPR, dubbed the mainstream media by skeptics. Conservative talkers have constructed a business model that lambastes the mainstream media as corrupt and biased, effectively stoking attitudes of suspicion and drawing listeners further into an information bubble. Ironically, like Fox News, they often do so by claiming to balance the scales. Rush Limbaugh famously says, "I don't need equal time, I am equal time." He's also on record calling government, academia, science, and the media the four corners of deceit. The message is simple. You can't trust them, but you can trust me. This is a common applause line among American conservatives. Former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin constantly rips the lamestream media. In 2020, when a CNN reporter approached Arizona Senator Martha McSally to inquire about evidence in the Trump impeachment trial, McSally responded, "You're a liberal hack. I'm not talking to you." Donald Trump constantly cries fake news. At his 2018 speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Kansas City, Trump said, "Just remember, what you are seeing and what you are reading is not what's happening." I'm reminded of that line from George Orwell, "The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command." Joel Schumacher's 1993 film, Falling Down, provides some commentary on America's angry white male. In the movie, Michael Douglas's character, William Foster, grows increasingly unhinged in the wake of his own misfortunes and feelings of persecution. He loses his job, his ex-wife takes out a restraining order. He sneers at high retail prices and rants about a fast food burger that looks nothing like the restaurant photos. He's accosted by a gang. He acquires weapons. He shoots up various establishments by accident or in frustration. He ultimately realizes he is the villain of his own story, gives up, and manipulates a police officer into killing him. Now, to be fair, Foster's motivations aren't driven by white supremacy. He's disgusted by the bigotry of an army surplus store owner. But he reflects the white male discontent felt by many American men. The American dream was not as advertised. It's all going wrong. Humanity is circling the drain. The time for half measures is over. Cognitive neuroscientist Dr. Bobby Azarian has examined common attitudes among political groups. In a 2016 Psychology Today column, he examines trends in the right and the left, and those trends are very telling. Conservatives are more prone to focus on the negative. When shown both positive and negative photographs, liberals were drawn more toward the good, happy children, cute animals, etc., while conservatives tended to dwell on the awful, car accidents, open wounds, that kind of thing. This negativity bias produces a heightened sense of danger. Threats seem bigger. The world looks more dangerous. Conservatives have a stronger physiological response to threats. In short, the data suggests that they scare more easily. In an unsafe world, they embrace a worldview that provides a feeling of safety. This explains much of the gun culture in America. Conservatives are more prone to fearing new experiences. While liberals own more books, travel more, and often seek adventure, conservatives are more inclined toward habit, seclusion, and orderliness. conservatives appear physically wired to be more reactive to fear. An MRI study at the University College London discovered a larger amygdala in people who identified as conservative. The amygdala is the part of the brain that processes emotion, and it's especially reactive to fearful stimuli. This last trend has been borne out in an earlier brain study conducted at Emory University. Psychologist Drew Weston determined that while Republicans and Democrats were both prone to in-group bias, Republicans supporting a political candidate were marginally more likely to insulate their own candidate while calling out hypocrisy in the opposition. As answers to various questions were given, MRI scans revealed that partisans were leaning on the emotional rather than logical parts of the brain. Weston chronicled these results in a 2008 book called The Political Brain: The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. This kind of protectionism extends to ideas. A 2008 Pew Research Center study revealed that Republicans were 23% less likely to change their minds when being educated about climate science. Even intelligent, college-degreed Republicans were statistically more likely to rationalize their positions. To quote science author Chris Mooney, they become smart idiots, more biased, and less persuadable. Conservatives are more likely to double down on an initial conviction, maneuvering their arguments in clever ways to fit the square peg into the round hole. The brain's emotion centers have blended the opinion into their identity, so an attack on the idea is a threat to the person. All human beings are prone to this way of thinking, but again, we're seeing more of it among Republicans. If conservative brains respond more quickly and more strongly to emotional appeals, it becomes easier to understand the evocative power of political ads, especially those playing to notions of American pride, security, dominance, and destiny. Candidate X will stand up against big government. Candidate X will protect your Second Amendment right. Candidate X will promote Christian values. Candidate X is tough on crime. Candidate X will strengthen borders. Candidate X will stand against un-American values. Many of us have a healthy cynicism about political advertisements. Most of them appear to have been mass-produced in an election factory. I spent 20 years in radio and video production. I've made several of these commercials. Positive ads are airbrushed in patriotic colors as the candidate eats cornbread with small-town citizens. Negative ads are grainy black-and-white horror films about the corruption and treason of the other guy. Most of these ads are, necessarily, I admit, skimpy on details about a candidate's specific platforms and plans. Instead, these commercials are broad caresses of America's heartstrings. They are targeting viewer emotion, and fear is a hugely powerful emotion. Fear of change, fear of harm, fear of the other, even fear of conflicting information that might produce palpable mental discomfort, known as cognitive dissonance. Fortunately for the Fox News Christian, conservative talk radio provides plenty of affirmation. Rush Limbaugh's audience agrees with him so frequently that they call themselves ditto heads. America is a Christian nation? Ditto. Guns are a human, American right? Ditto. Immigrants are threatening American jobs? Ditto. Climate science is bogus? Ditto. Liberals want to dismantle our republic? Ditto. I was once a ditto head. My own radio career began in 1990. I worked for a Tulsa Christian music station, mostly spinning discs, giving the time and weather, and talking about benign lifestyle topics. When my air shift was finished, I caught Rush Limbaugh's broadcast on AM 740 KRMG during the drive home. I didn't care much for the caller segments, but Rush would populate the first 15 minutes of every hour with a can't-miss monologue that pressed all of my Republican buttons. I'd begin the commute in relative relaxation. By the time I got home, I'd be coiled up like a spring. My amygdala was effectively engaged. Limbaugh began his national broadcast on August 1, 1988, graduating to the big leagues after experiencing massive local success in Sacramento, California. Rush's national launch was wedged between the 1988 presidential conventions, and his meteoric rise aligned with the 1990 Gulf War. He was lightning in a bottle. By the time the Limbaugh empire had expanded to 650 stations nationwide, he had become the darling of the Republican Party. Rush's philosophies had been succinctly summed up in his 1988 article penned for the Sacramento Union, titled Undeniable Truths, and this is still posted proudly on rushlimbaugh.com. Just a few of the points follow. Ours is a world governed by the aggressive use of force. There is only one way to get rid of nuclear weapons. Use them. Freedom is God-given. The peace movement in the United States, whether by accident or design, is pro-communist. Evolution cannot explain creation. Feminism was established to allow unattractive women access to the mainstream of society. There will always be poor people. This is not the fault of the rich. You should thank God for making you an American, and instead of feeling guilty about it, help spread our ideas worldwide. I never stopped to unpack these troubling claims. Instead, I was emboldened by Rush's fearless rhetoric about dominance. Of course, I didn't want nuclear war, but I was convinced that half measures guaranteed defeat. If victory meant leaning on the button, especially if it resulted in non-American casualties only, well, so be it. I swelled with pride at Limbaugh's defiant defense of the armed forces, unaware of the irony that Rush had enjoyed a deferment from any military service. Even more ironically, the first hour of Rush Limbaugh's radio show was broadcast every weekday on the Armed Forces Radio Network. I was a devout Christian who considered divorce a sin. Yet I was untroubled by Limbaugh's multiple marriages. In the 1990s, he was on his third of four wives. I claimed a desire for gender equality, but I'd bought into the Limbaugh lie that feminazis were man-hating malcontents, and I recoiled when Gloria Steinem talked about revolution. Rush often boasted he was a fan of the women's movement, when he was walking behind it. He also claimed that women still live longer than men because their lives are easier. I had no children, but I was staunchly anti-abortion. When Rush Limbaugh's 1992 best-selling book claimed that militant feminists are pro-choice because it's their ultimate avenue of power over men, I blindly accepted the notion that feminists sought to eliminate the rights of fathers even as they murdered their unborn. My own mother predicted that conservatives would eventually breed themselves into statistical dominance because liberals were aborting future generations. I'd never known a woman who had an abortion. I'd never been faced with an unwanted pregnancy or impending birth defect. I laughed when Rush Limbaugh suddenly cut off unwanted callers with collar abortions. He played the sound of a toilet flushing and the callers were gone. I'm ashamed of my callousness. Rush's lampooning of homosexuals fortified my biblically informed view that gays were in rebellion against God and destined for hell. I commonly used gay as a slur. That's so gay. Don't be gay. You're being totally gay. As I mention in a later chapter, this attitude would shatter after I was confronted with my own bigotry. In the early 1990s, my knowledge of AIDS was pathetically limited. I considered it the gay disease. I had little sympathy for the tens of thousands infected with HIV, not because I consciously hated homosexuals, but because my empathy had been dulled by hate the sin, love the sinner piety. As such, when Rush quipped about AIDS prevention by not asking, quote, another man to bend over and make love at the exit point, I smirked with nonchalance. Sure, people were dying, but they weren't my people, and it wasn't my problem. The problem was that the victims weren't straight, conservative, or Christian. They needed to get their lives right. They needed Jesus. My social circles were colorless. I was as white as my friends, and they were as white as their friends. I had enjoyed the privilege of a middle-class income, private schools, and plenty of relationship and career opportunities, and yet I somehow felt that persecution lay just over every horizon. Except for a few black conservatives like Alan Keyes and Clarence Thomas, black Americans leaned heavily into the Democratic Party, linking them in my mind. The Democrats were Jesse Jackson. The Democrats were Al Sharpton. The Democrats were liberals, and liberals were un-American. Even as I was freshly emerging from my religious faith in 2008, I remained in opposition to presidential candidate Barack Obama over his liberal ideas. In 2007, Rush referred to Obama, whose mother was white, as a half-frickin' American. Later that same year, Limbaugh's show featured a parody song titled Barack the Magic Negro. I resisted these racial slurs, but I resisted the Democratic Party even more. I was a Christian dominionist. I believed that the earth and all its resources were created by God for the pleasure and purpose of man. As the Bible said, the highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth He has given to humankind. Psalm chapter 115, verse 16. The land was ours. The animals were ours. The oil was ours. The forests were ours. And it was arrogant to believe that humans could ever have a lasting negative global impact. When Rush Limbaugh claimed that volcanic eruptions disproved all notions of human-caused climate change, producing more ozone-depleting chemicals in one burst than the whole industrialized world, I nodded in approval. No need to consult actual climate scientists. Those lefty university elites, they were part of the four corners of deceit. Rush Limbaugh championed the idea of the rugged individualist. His attitude perhaps best encapsulated in a statement on his September 7, 2010 radio monologue. Quote, America was built by people who fended for themselves, who expected nothing from the government except protection. They expected nothing from the government except protection from foreign enemies and a just rule of law. Other than that, stay the hell out of our lives. There's some truth to the claim that Rush became a ratings giant on talent and hard work. But he was born in the American heartland in a family of lawyers. He was never forced to walk in the shoes of a suppressed minority. He hadn't been rejected from a job or pulled over in a vehicle because of his skin color. He hadn't received a smaller paycheck or been sexually harassed because he was a woman. He never feared physical harm because he was gay or transsexual. Beyond that, Limbaugh's attitudes reflected the 1960s attitudes of Robert Welch, founder of the conservative extremist group, the John Birch Society. The John Birch Society was a radical conservative group formed during the paranoia of the Cold War. It opposed the civil rights movement. It opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, part of a communist plot. It warned of a one-world government. The John Birch Society was so extreme that even conservative icon William F. Buckley Jr. kept his distance. Robert Welch often waxed nostalgic for the earlier, simpler days of 1900, when rugged individualism culled the successful from the failed, the rich from the poor, the powerful from the weak. It was the time before social programs like welfare. Women couldn't vote. Child labor laws didn't exist. Homosexuals were called sodomites. The country was racially segregated. The good old days. Welch's philosophy was an economically Darwinian one, survival of the fittest. Sure, some people were poor, but if they didn't propel themselves into the American dream, it was their own fault. In fact, their low status would be a healthy motivator to rise and overcome. And if anyone fell through the cracks, it was merely the price of liberty, collateral damage. This was Limbaugh's doctrine, rooted in a mythical past, and it obviously favored white men. In this sense, Rush and I had much in common. On our purchase of privilege, we claim that success and or failure was completely the responsibility of those who simply needed to buck up and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, like or dislike her, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was absolutely correct when she tweeted that it's a physical impossibility to lift yourself up by a bootstrap. Indeed, there are many who are genuinely, tragically, locked into cycles of poverty and misery. The socially disadvantaged can bootstrap until their hands are bloody, but they remain hamstrung by circumstance and the system. Perhaps what's most notable about the popularity of hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage isn't their huge ratings. Shock radio has long used controversy to get attention. No, what's most striking is the constant, even gleeful, absence of empathy. Rush Limbaugh's audience is 80% conservative, mostly men, which brings us back to their statistically greater aversion to out-group acceptance. How often have Limbaugh and Savage pitched themselves and their audiences against the other, the liberal, the gay, the feminist, the black, the Muslim, and more? Conservative talk radio has a reinforcing effect. The more you listen, the more you distrust the outside world. The more you distrust the outside world, the more you listen. It doesn't take long before your world is a terrarium. Rush Limbaugh paved the way for Fox News, which paved the way for President Donald Trump. Limbaugh and Trump are eerily similar. They both avoided the draft while waxing about military action. They both race-baited black Americans and linked whiteness to the national identity. They've promoted distrust of journalists. They think climate science is a scam. They've warned that political correctness will destroy everything America stands for. They're both petty and cruel to other people. And they've cultivated an angry, paranoid, often alarmingly ignorant and bigoted audience, clutching desperately to its God and guns. Filmmaker Jen Senko produced a fascinating 2016 documentary. It's called The Brainwashing of My Dad. Senko's father, Frank, was once a non-political Kennedy Democrat, until he started listening to Rush Limbaugh in the 1990s. Frank became obsessed with conservative talk radio. He devoured Rush Limbaugh on his long daytime commutes, and he huddled with his headphones for evening shows by other right-wing hosts. His wife and children watched in alarm as he acted more and more like a member of a cult. Frank Senko became increasingly isolated and agitated, addicted to outrage. After long Limbaugh sessions in the car, Senko would rant feverishly to everyone within earshot about welfare queens, environmental wackos, feminazis, and of course, the liberal media. Senko became a conspiracy theorist, fretting constantly about threats against America, avoiding any disconfirming data, and drowning himself in right-wing email newsletters. He was so vitriolic that his own family came to avoid him. In his book, Freedom of Mind, brainwashing expert Stephen Hassan describes cult tactics with something he calls the BITE model, which breaks down as follows: behavioral control, information control, thought control, emotional control. By carefully shaping the narrative, using loaded language, teaching thought-stopping techniques, stoking divisions, fueling distrust, and claiming to be the only reliable source for truth, cults effectively lock their members into an alternate reality. These cults and cult leaders don't just shape the world, they become the world. They are the reality beyond reality, which often explains the cult-like nature of right-wing radio. A friend of mine, Steve, was featured in the film The Brainwashing of My Dad. He had once been a ditto head. After I saw the film, I called Steve to get more information. Turns out Steve had voted for Clinton in 1992 and held fairly progressive opinions until he began listening to Rush Limbaugh on his 55-mile commute to work. As the Rush rage spilled into his car, Steve began to change. In his words, quote, The more I listened, the angrier I became. Or maybe the more I listened, the more I channeled the natural anger and frustrations of a young man into a new direction. I was suddenly alarmed at the state of our once great nation. I could see how our moral fabric was being torn asunder, and our freedoms were being eroded before our very eyes. We were surely on a path to ruin, and idiots like me who had voted Democrat had paved that path right over the graves of all the great and noble people who built this country. Steve finished his thoughts with this sobering line. I had been brainwashed by people I'd never even met. Steve and I were much like Frank Senko, white, male, Republican, and mad at the world. Fortunately, we both escaped the right-wing outrage machine. Regarding Frank, it was only when his radio broke, his TV channel changed, and his wife unsubscribed him from the conspiracy sites, replacing them with more liberal content, that a deprogramming began to take place. His jaw loosened, his heart relaxed, his outlook improved, his world expanded. Soon after, Frank stunned his wife when he declared that he supported gay marriage. In the 2012 presidential election, Frank Senko voted for Obama. Now, the Fox News Christian, and perhaps my skeptical listeners, might be quick to protest that Frank Senko traded one bias for another. It's fair to acknowledge that progressive media informed his shift in attitudes and values. But with Frank, I'm most interested in the transformation in the man. In his post-Rush life, Frank became less prone to anger, more balanced, kinder. His daughter declared, "There's finally been peace in our house. My dad is more content than I've ever seen him." The days of rage, paranoia, and division are behind him, and family bonds have been restored. Yet there are still more than 600 radio stations blasting Rush Limbaugh to tens of millions of people every week. And Rush was recently elevated even higher on the American political ladder. On Limbaugh's February 3, 2020 radio show, he announced to his listeners that he had been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. Detractors basked in the irony, as the cigar-smoking host is on record declaring, "There is no conclusive proof that nicotine's addictive, and the same thing with cigarettes causing emphysema, lung cancer, heart disease." Talk about fake news, right? In the wake of the cancer announcement, at President Trump's 2020 State of the Union address, Rush Limbaugh was awarded America's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Donald Trump lauded Rush's, quote, "decades of tireless devotion to our country and the millions of people a day that you speak to and inspire." The moment was historic for all the wrong reasons. A disgraceful radio host who once claimed that AIDS is the only federally protected virus, who suggested that actor Michael J. Fox was faking his Parkinson's symptoms, and who told Sean Hannity in 2008 that Barack Obama was a veritable rookie whose only chance of winning is that he's black. This man was given the distinction of Great American. In my conservative youth, I might have stood and applauded. Today, I'm genuinely discouraged about the people we call heroes. There is a broader, more beautiful sound beyond the narrow bands of right-wing radio. It's fairer, more reasonable, more optimistic, more compassionate, and more American. It's the sound of a better humanity, and it deserves to be heard. And that's it. Chapter 2 of Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian. You can find all the details and the purchase links at my personal website, SethAndrews.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks so much for your support. I'll see you back here next time.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.